Welcome, everybody, to Redacted on this Tuesday. I'm Clayton Morris.
I'm Natalie Morris.
And your AirPods are here. I'm going to put those away. Welcome into the show. On today's show, we've got a very busy show. We're going to be looking at the latest destruction plans for Gaza. And maybe this is exactly why J.D. Vance called off his trip to Gaza, or to Israel, because of the operation that is now underway to flatten the rest of the remaining homes that are there and to displace 2 million individuals. We'll talk about that.
Plus, we're going to talk about new FDA rules around the COVID vaccine. They say now they require clinical trials before they approve it. But you know there's a but, right? I'm going to show you the most recent clinical trial around the Novavax COVID vaccine, and you may not get so excited about this just yet. So there's more sort of holding the government's feet to the fire, so to speak.
We're going to talk about a bunch of things related to Ukraine today, Putin and President Trump and their peace talks. Rachel Blevins is going to join us here on that story. We're also going to talk about Poland, and the Polish people are basically done with Ukrainians. Even the BBC is now acknowledging that Ukrainians are being told, go home. You're done. Go home. Get out of our country. Social unrest throughout the country of Poland and Alberta. Yes, moving forward with separation plans from Canada after Mark Carney's election and these crazy climate policies, which could absolutely debilitate Alberta. We'll talk about all of that and more on today's show. So welcome in. Thank you for subscribing. Thank you for being a part of our great community here. So we'll get to all of that news. But first,
we want to tell you about our show sponsor, which is IQ Mix. This is a zero sugar drink mix from IQ Bar. The same company that makes the bars also makes a drink mix that you can carry with you. And it is delicious. This is something we actually really do drink and eat in our house. We do eat these bars. We do keep these electrolyte packs. And the reason being, I think I've shared with you many times, my son is a migrainer. If you haven't seen our interview about migraines with Dr. Angela Stanton, please watch it. But it is essential for migrainers to have electrolytes at all times. So we use this for him. He keeps it with him at all times. If he starts to feel an aura right away, he takes this. And, you know, the rest of us who are not migrainers actually enjoy the bars. We enjoy the mixes. They come in 7 refreshing flavors. They are free from gluten, sugar, soy, and GMO. They even are certified vegan and kosher. So again, these are really great meal supplements that we use in this house. In fact, we just moved house. And so, you know, you can't use your kitchen for weeks on end until while you're moving. So these were great meal replacements. And also I put them in my kids' lunches. So check them out for yourself because really, I think these things are great. And when, you know, this mom approved, I read the label and I'm like, yes, this is good. This is great for you. So right now, text redacted to 64000 and you'll get 20% off plus free shipping. Check them out. And is there an URL? I don't see one here. So I guess they just want you to text. They're offering our special listeners 20% off plus free shipping. So again, to get your 20% off, text redacted to 64000 and check them out. IQ Bar. It's something we really like in this house and I'm happy to tell you about it.
All right. Well, Vice President J.D. Vance had a trip planned to Israel for Tuesday, but reportedly canceled it in the wake of Israel's military operation in Gaza. Now, the Vance team cited logistical reasons for canceling the trip, but didn't expand on that. But Axios quotes a U.S. official who says the decision was made because the VP didn't want his trip to suggest that the Trump administration endorsed the Israeli decision to launch a massive operation at a time when the U.S. is pushing for a ceasefire and a hostage deal. End quote.
Oh. Optics are kind of bad.
That's, yeah. So you know. What kind of massive operation exactly are we talking about here? Well, Israel is calling it Operation Gideon's Chariots, and it's a full-scale invasion of Gaza with an attempt to displace every single one of the remaining 2 million civilians who live there. It also involves Israeli airstrikes, ground troops, armored divisions, naval units on a level not ever seen before. It also involves completely leveling buildings that they've already bombed. So take a look at this. Here you can see part of this operation where the entire area has already been totally decimated, but now Israel is destroying the rest of it, presumably to start building new condo complexes, shopping centers, all of that. Israel says they have issued evacuation warnings via leaflets and text messages. So the media and civilians who stick around will die. By the way, I love that they have, can we play that video again? I love that they have drone footage. Like, here's what it looks like. Here's exactly what we're handling right now. We've got, this is drone footage. Like, we're going to hover here and here's the area we're going to completely level. We've already killed all the people here. So let's just flatten the rest of it. Mr. Drone, just start flying up, get a better visual of the clouds here.
Easy pan down.
Yeah, get a nice glamour shot.
Yes, we're going to do that to you, but didn't you get my text? I told you to get out of there. So,
yeah, so explain
that's
that.
Not I on mean, me.
So explain that. They sent these text messages out.
Right, which begs the question, how do they have every Palestinian's text number? How do they have access to the Palestinian's cell network? But okay, we know how, right? It's just a big blaring question. But yeah, they say, look, we distribute leaflets. We told you we're going to do this. If you stick around, that's on you. It's like when a gecko gets in your house and dies, like you came here. That's on you. It's not my bad decision. That's basically their explanation for all of this.
Yeah, exactly. So again, we sent you text messages. We told you, hey, pay attention. And if you're still there, then sorry, we want you to go to these safe zones. But of course, many of the safe zones have already been destroyed. So basically,
well,
nothing
that's
is
happened
safe.
Before when they told them to go to the Rafah crossing, and then
yeah,
they bombed
it.
That
yeah.
while they were en route. So, you know, would you trust the Israeli government and go to the safe zone that they have indicated is safe when, if past is prologue, that's where more bombs will be?
Dan Spalding, even in our chat room, brings up a great point. Says, how do the Palestinians even have a charged phone that works in that rubble?
Right, yeah. Exactly. And that's exactly what the United Nations says, is they can't charge their phones. You can't rely on the fact that they'll get a text from you. Get out or die. Do you want me to take this?
No. Yeah.
Okay. Well, France, the United Kingdom, and Canada issued a joint condemnation of this Israeli military operation on Monday. Now, again, we've been seeing Emmanuel Macron continuously speaking on behalf of the Palestinian people. So this is not necessarily new, but they are ratcheting up the threats, which they have never done before. So they joined forces now with the United Kingdom and Canada. They say that Israel's reaction to October 7th is wholly disproportionate. They call out the Netanyahu government for breach of international humanitarian law. They say that if Israel does not stop it, let through the aid, stop bombing civilians, then they are committed to recognizing a Palestinian state as a contribution to achieving a two-state solution and are prepared to work with others to that end. I mean, what's a state there? Like, you saw the land. They're recognizing that as a country now. What's left to recognize? But they also sort of issue a, what do you call it? A veiled threat is what I'm looking for. A veiled threat that we could start to pull back any international relations with Israel because of this. So, you know, the UK has such a small Jewish population. This won't cost them the same way that it would the United Kingdom. But they're saying we will look at sanctions. We will look at, you know, what we've done to Russia. Do you believe that they would do this? I don't know. And it would not have the same effect as if the United States did. They don't supply the same level of weaponry. Now, Netanyahu, of course, did not take kindly to this statement. He called this a huge prize for Hamas, told them, you need to follow President Trump's lead, which means Trump does what I say. You need to do that. He does not condemn me for bombing the civilians. That's the behavior I expect of you. Follow the Trump template. He also added, we will take control of all the territory of the Strip. So it seems to be, yeah. I mean, we study this, we read it, and we're like, this is happening. Israel will take Gaza. There's nothing anyone can, the only person, we talked about this last week, that can do anything about it is Donald Trump. And it does not seem that the appetite really is there for the Americans to make it stop.
I see a bunch of people in the chat just saying how disappointed they are. Like,
in us?
No, not in us.
In the United States?
We don't have anything to do with Gaza, but no, saying basically President Trump and what the Trump administration is doing. Slick 102 says, what about the U.S. doing something for F's sake? Trump totally walked back his crap, totally walked this crap back. I don't think
Donald Trump made us a promise to speak on behalf of the Palestinians on the campaign. It has always been apparent that he is willing to allow Israel to do as it pleases. I don't think that should be a surprise to us, even though we've seen condemnation of Netanyahu. We've seen him build bridges with other Middle Eastern countries. We've seen him speak against the suffering of the people in Gaza without acknowledging who is causing it. This sort of feeble attempt continues. We know that, but it feels awful to be living my life knowing that an entire nation is being destroyed before our very eyes. We were warned by Holocaust tales not to do this, not to let it happen again, and we're powerless against it.
Well, fireworks on Capitol Hill. Secretary of State Marco Rubio says Syria is just 2 weeks away from civil war. I wonder whose fault that was. Syria, one of the most peaceful countries in the world for a while, until Barack Obama decided to destroy that country and Biden's CIA then ousted Assad. So Marco Rubio has this to say about the...
Do you want me to use ChatGPT to answer that?
No, I don't. But Marco Rubio can answer it. Go ahead.
The bad news is that the transitional authority figures, they didn't pass their background check with the FBI, okay? They've got a tough history and one that we understand. But on the flip side of it is, if we engage them, it may work out, it may not work out. If we did not engage them, it was guaranteed to not work out. In fact, it is our assessment that, frankly, the transitional authority, given the challenges they're facing, are maybe weeks, not many months, away from potential collapse and a full-scale civil war of epic proportions, basically the country splitting up. The good news is that there is a Syrian national identity. It is one of the places in the Middle East where Alawis and Druze and Christians and Sunni and Shia have lived along, and Kurds have lived alongside each other underneath the banner of a Syrian identity until it was broken by a butcher, Assad, who pitted them against each other. So they face a number of challenges.
Yeah, that last part is wrong, of course. But nevertheless... Syria, we've been warning you about, is about to face, I mean, it's already facing disaster, of course, a genocide already unfolding there. And, of course, President Trump shaking hands with this terrorist, Jolani, last week in Saudi Arabia. Why is this happening? I don't exactly know what's happening here.
Clayton's phone keeps trying to ring in on the conversation.
Yeah, so I do not want to talk to you.
You need to tell it that we're busy.
Okay, I'll turn that off. But there were more fireworks, by the way, when Democrat senators who had voted for Rubio now said that they regretted it because our position of deporting illegals, cutting USAID. Imagine having problem with cutting USAID fraud. But Senator Chris Van Hollen is upset about it. Watch.
I have to tell you directly and personally that I regret voting for you for Secretary of State. I yield back.
May I respond?
You may, sir.
Well, first of all, your regret for voting for me confirms I'm doing a good job based on what I know.
Well, that's just a flippant statement, Mr. Secretary.
Can I respond, Mr. Chairman?
You
Mr.
may.
I didn't ask.
Senator,
questions.
Please let the Secretary
I'd
have
be
the
happy
floor.
To, but then I can respond to his.
Your
response.
Time's up, Senator, and woefully used, I might add.
Well,
your remarks do not represent the view of this committee.
Well, Mr.
Secretary,
Chairman.
Please.
Well, I'd like to. I can't respond to everything he said because much of these are untrue, but I'll go through a few. First of all, I'm actually very proud of the work we've done with USAID. For example, I don't regret cutting $10 million for male circumcisions in Mozambique. I don't know how that makes us stronger and more prosperous as a nation.
I
don't regret
Sudan,
cycle
Mr.
social
Secretary.
Support services.
I raised Sudan, Mr. Secretary.
Can I respond,
not
Senator?
Senator,
I'd ask you to suspend. You had 7 straight minutes of
I chose to use my time that way, Mr. Chairman. That's my right to
Please
use
suspend,
my time that way.
Secretary Rubio.
Well, I can go on. I mean, there's other things here. We spent $227,000 for Big Cat's YouTube channel from USAID. We spent $14 million for social cohesion in Mali, whatever the hell that means. So I can go on and on. I got the list here, and there's more. I didn't even bring the whole list. In the case of El Salvador, absolutely. Absolutely. We deported gang members. Gang members, including the one you had a margarita with. And that guy is a human trafficker, and that guy is a gangbanger, and the evidence is going to be clear. In the days to come, you're
going
to see who you went to
defend.
Senator,
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman.
Secretary Rubio has the floor.
Mr. Chairman, he can't make unsubstantiated
Senator,
comments like that.
Secretary Rubio has the floor. You
Secretary
had your
Rubio
time.
Secretary Rubio should take that testimony to the federal
Senator,
court of the United States because
well,
he hasn't done it under oath.
Ouch. Well, they do not like having their money cut off. They do not like USAID cutting off. They certainly don't like the fact that we are deporting and cutting off the visas for illegal aliens, for gangbangers and other people like that. Certainly upsetting those individuals.
You know, speaking of, I was thinking about this, and maybe you don't care about this, but I do. So Angelina Jolie at a Cannes Film Festival this weekend was asked about USAID, and she said, I'm really sickened and angry about it because she presents herself as this humanitarian, as this erudite, well-studied humanitarian, so caring about the world that she adopts children from Africa, that it's absolutely, you know, I know things that you don't. And Vogue magazine for years has presented her as somebody knowed and learned. And I bought that when I was young and liked fashion magazines. But all she has to do is read one stinking book and realize that USAID has funded the drug trade that has caused hundreds of thousands of deaths in Southeast Asia. And then she'd be done. She wouldn't speak on behalf of this. So I feel, watching her speak on behalf of USAID, like she's been a psyop all along for young women. And I'm pissed about it because it doesn't take very much. It's like at the beginning of the first whistleblower book about the drug trade, you see USAID like threatening rice farmers, food for drugs, that kind of thing. Like, you don't have to study that much to know that. And I'm pissed about it because I bought that dumb shit about Angelina Jolie. This is not about her, but it is. Like, I was thinking about that today, about how you have these elites who are supposed, like George Clooney, who are supposedly so well-read, they don't know. And so we follow them like, oh, yeah, we really need to adopt black children in Africa. We need to, you know, send them money. That's racism. And I'm done with it. And I'm pissed at, like, I'm pissed that she was used in that way and that she's not smarter and that I fell for it. I'm pissed at myself more than anything else.
Well, I mean, again, these people live in a bubble. And so they are, when you surround yourself with this bubble, when you don't go outside of that bubble at all, you're very likely not to ever have someone in a dinner conversation kind of challenge you on this. And you have so many people that are sycophants who are surrounding Angelina Jolie. People are making lots of money off of her assistants and aides who are worried about taking care of her hair and everything. Do you think that anyone's sitting there on the couch and combing her hair being like, well, Angelina, yeah, you may really want to reconsider your position on USAID.
No, clearly not. Clearly not. But I think that the way that she's presented to, like, a young woman, I remember reading profiles on her, and I'm like, wow, she's so beautiful. She's married to Brad Pitt. She seems to know so much about Sudan. They tell me, you know, these profiles in Vogue where she's sitting there in, like, cute cutoff jeans, and her hair is in a ponytail, and she's surrounded by, you know, policy documents that she's reading on her own. And what is, you know, a young girl who has not done that reading is going to think, oh, she really knows that. Okay, then I'm going to listen to her. We really need to be a charity society. So anyway, okay, I'll stop going on about that because we have more to talk about. I want to talk about the FDA's approval of COVID vaccines, because the FDA now says it will no longer approve COVID vaccines without clinical trials for the general population. So from now on, it will only approve COVID vaccines for adults age 65 and over and individuals age 6 months and older that have at least one high-risk condition, like asthma, diabetes, cancer, obesity. Okay, this comes from a New England Journal of Medicine publication by the new FDA commissioner, Marty Makary, and Dr. Vinay Prasad, the head of the FDA Center for Biologics Evaluation and Research. It means no approval of new COVID vaccines for the general population unless there are real clinical trials, not emergency ones, not rushed ones like we had before. Now, the FDA policy does not mean that it will be removed from the childhood vaccine schedule because the CDC makes that decision. So for now, the COVID vaccines will stay there. Even though some of them were only tested on mice, they still will remain in the childhood vaccine schedule. Hopefully the CDC does something about that. Now, at the very least, it means that these shots going forward will need full approval. But before you get too excited about that, I want to show you how this is currently working in practice, because there is still a major concern to this approach. Now, last week, the Food and Drug Administration issued an approval for the Novavax COVID-19 vaccine. This is the only non-mRNA vaccine. Actually, I believe Johnson & Johnson also doesn't have mRNA, but the one on the market. The vaccine was approved for adults ages 65 and older and individuals 12 and up with one underlying health condition. Now, it did have clinical trials, but too bad for them, I read them. And here is the major problem. The trials had, some groups had one vaccine and some groups had two 21 days apart. Well, the trials only showed a reduction in symptomatic COVID 7 days after the second shot. But the FDA didn't approve two shots. This FDA approval is only for one shot of Novavax. So is one shot even effective at preventing COVID? We don't know. That was not tested. So why in a clinical trial would you give someone a vaccine and then not test them for whether or not they... That makes no sense. So the only data we have on the effectiveness of the Novavax vaccine is for two doses, but the FDA approved one dose. So there's no publicly available data showing that a single dose of Novavax prevents COVID. That's weird. When they say that the shot lowers the risk of COVID, there's also holes there. They didn't test everyone who got the vaccine. They only did tests on people who showed symptoms within 7 days. So there could have been people who got it on the eighth day. There could have been asymptomatic cases. We don't know. And this vaccine is only proven to lower immunity within 7 days. What happens after 7 days? Who the heck knows? We don't know. So would you get a vaccine for 7 whole days of immunity, especially if it came with the risks of myocarditis, heart inflammation, and also eye inflammation? Those risks seem lower than the Moderna and Pfizer risks of that, but that still remains a concern. Plus, there was a serious event of Guillain-Barré syndrome, and the FDA notes that Novavax can issue this vaccine, but follow up on that. If anyone else gets this, let us know. Also, the company Novavax has to tell the FDA how the vaccine does when it starts being shipped to hospitals. So they don't know. They have not tested. Can you put it in a truck? Can you refrigerate it? Can you get it to the doctor's office? Does it still have the same formulation once it gets there? They literally don't know. They said by July, Novavax must submit a study called shipping evaluation to see how the vaccine has done in the real world, meaning they haven't tested it, which is actually not that uncommon of practice that the FDA will approve a vaccine and not know at all how it does in the transportation cycle, which is crazy, right? They test it on us. Who knows what it's going to do when it's like jiggled around in a truck, flown on an airplane. They literally don't know. And the FDA says, we'll approve you for now. Let us know by July how that does. So why would someone take this given that the dosage was not trialed? I mean, it was, but we don't have effectivity for that dosage. And its effectivity rate is not known for that dosage. Plus, we don't know how it does in the real world. And especially given such a low prevalence of COVID right now. Look how little COVID there is in the United States right now. So your guess is as good as mine. So even though the Novavax vaccine did have trials, there are not really any trials the population should trust. And it's only being approved for compromised populations. And the approval was not even based on those trials. So is this what we should expect now that the Food and Drug Administration says, well, we're going to require trials? But I don't want trials like this. We want real trials. At the very least, Dr. Macri does lay this out. He says he wants at least trials to be on humans, not mice, as the second Pfizer and Moderna vaccines were. He wants them to be based on true saline placebos, which the original vaccines did do. But still, they're only testing for symptomatic COVID, and there's no requirement for how long they have to test that population. So again, if it's only 7 days, for 7 days you won't get COVID, that's not it. Surely Dr. Macri knows this. Maybe since we seem to think he's a well-intentioned doctor, he was one of the few honest voices during the pandemic. Surely these concerns about the Novavax approval did not escape his attention, but he's only been in office since April, so a few weeks. Maybe that one slipped past him. Surely he knows that in order to trust any COVID vaccine, that the public must see a lasting reduction in severe COVID due to the vaccine and a major reduction in the side effects that are still an issue. So I don't know, maybe this is just the first step of buttoning this up, but Rome wasn't built in a day. Let me know what you think of these vaccine trials that we are seeing.
Well, the U.S. federal government just posted a new job opportunity for you. There are a few caveats, though. You'll be stationed near a tropical island, working long hours with cutting-edge rocket technology. The sunrises, of course, are beautiful there. The pay is decent and the vacation time is solid. Oh, and by the way, the island is radioactive and you might die of cancer. Would you like to take that job? Because that's exactly what's happening. The U.S. Space Force, yes, that's still a thing, is preparing to test commercial rockets on Johnson Atoll, which is a remote Pacific island about 800 miles from Hawaii. Here is Johnson Atoll, which is a U.S. Air Force base. You can see the U.S. Air Force base there. Sounds harmless, right? Except this place has a horrific past. The locals are already saying, oh, not this again. Really? We're going to go through this again? Back in the 1940s and 50s, Johnson Atoll was one of the U.S. military's favorite nuclear playgrounds, along with, of course, Bikini Atoll in the Marshall Islands. It was part of a series of nuclear tests where they would drop atomic and hydrogen bombs on the island, old Navy ships, coral reefs, to see how they would respond. And if that meant blowing holes in the ocean, contaminating paradise, so be it. That's fine. It was all in the name of science.
And beating the Soviets.
Yeah. And beating
the Soviets to the nuclear race.
Yeah. Well, we had already beat them to it by launching the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But, you know, we were racing further to build more sophisticated weapons. Yeah. And, you know, but here's, and by the way, the Soviets were watching all of these tests and they publicly said, we're not impressed.
Is that true?
That is true. They said, we're not impressed. They're like, yeah, okay. For the first one they dropped, they totally missed the target. They couldn't even get it where they needed to go. And the Soviets were like, not too interesting to us. Anyway, but here's what they don't want to tell you. This wasn't just some dusty corner of nowhere. These were lush living ecosystems. And now, the coral's dead, irradiated. The fish vanished. The land glows at night. Well, not really. But the radiation levels are still so high there that no one dares live there. The atoll is officially a U.S. wildlife refuge because humans aren't supposed to stay there. But wait, actually, it gets much worse. Bikini Atoll, the more infamous cousin of Johnston Atoll, this is where the U.S. military did something even more grotesque because in 1946, they wanted to test a massive nuke underwater. So what did they do? Well, they told the native residents of the island, hey, pack up your shit and leave so that we can blow up their island. Here, the residents can be seen packing up their things, putting them on a Navy ship. They invited the island's residents to go aboard the Navy ships, gave them front row seats to basically watch them blow up their home. Here's the king of the island invited on board to watch his island blown up.
The evacuated ruler of Bikini, King Judah, gets a front row seat at the bomb blast as he arrives aboard the Mount McKinley and is greeted by Admiral Blandy, Joint Task Force 1 commander.
Yeah. Isn't that amazing? So the king's like, hey, okay, I get a front row seat to watch you blow up my island. There's actual archive footage, yes, where showing it right in front of Navy officers, reassuring locals, smiling, shaking their hands, right before detonating a bomb that irradiated their homes. Watch.
The awful roar of the blast, equal to a discharge of 60,000 depth charges, each weighing 600 pounds, strikes the ears of the observers. Many miles away, the raging might of searing flame, crushing force, and deadly radioactive water is seen falling in a killing mist as the great circular wall of sea closes in on the guinea pig fleet.
The way that that guy, that was horrible and terrifying.
I love that. The guinea pig fleet, America, ready to blow up their island.
We might all die. News at 11.
News of the Pacific is back again, and Americans blowing up more islands. Native population being moved off. Here is the press. They also invited members of the press, which I'm actually okay with this. They stood there, and they asked them to basically film it. Hey, just stand right here. You'll get some good shots. We don't know how it'll sear your skin off later or anything like that, but, you know, it's fine. Just get some good film footage of this. Get some radiation and some good film. And sailors who were on board at the time, many got cancer. Here they are being used as guinea pigs to see how their bodies would react to just basically watching the blast. Like, oh, yeah, at least you're covering your heads a little bit. At least they bent their head downs a little bit. You know, by bending your head down a little bit in the middle of a nuclear blast, like, you should be fine. Should be totally fine.
Thank you for that. This is not real medical advice. Yeah.
Yeah, this is not duck and cover medical advice. Yeah, just if you ever see a nuclear blast.
Please do not expose yourself to nuclear bombs.
Just do this.
Yeah.
Don't. You'll be fine.
I mean, you could also put a paper bag on your head. That may help. I don't know.
Yeah. Probably more effective, actually. But don't worry, though. They were finally given the paltry sum of $75,000 for their cancers. That's right. This was a series of over 20 bombs that they dropped here. One of the tests created a 2,000-foot-wide crater in the seafloor. That explosion triggered a massive tsunami that tossed warships around like bath toys, contaminated everything from the radioactive fallout. And then after the blast, the U.S. told the islanders, hey, they could go home soon. Well, that was a total lie. Bikini Atoll remains uninhabitable to this day. But they told them in the 1960s, hey, go back home. We think it's fine. Just go back home. That was a mistake. So these people went back home, and then they studied their bodies, studied their bloodstream, and found out that they had levels of cesium-137 in all these returnees who had come back. 75% increase in their bodies. So, you know, cancer. Then they said, you know what? Maybe that wasn't such a good idea, so we'll move you 400 miles away. Again. Better not return home anytime soon. So back to the Johnston Atoll a second. Even though there were no local civilians living there at the time of testing, the U.S. knowingly exposed soldiers and contractors to radiation. There's also photos and film of there standing there, eyes wide. Yeah, they're just like looking on. Here are these sailors just being used, watching a nuclear fireball with zero protection, no suits, no shielding, just skin and bone, absorbing gamma rays in the name of national security. And the sailors described it as night turning into day with intense heat on their skin. And now, of course, the Space Force is marching right back in. One Hawaiian conservation group called it a slap in the face to the people and wildlife still recovering years later from what they called decades of chemical warfare. By the way, Johnston Atoll was also used for millions of gallons of Agent Orange in that spot. Same chemical that caused widespread birth defects and cancer during the Vietnam War. They also stored sarin gas there, VX nerve gas on the island. So this is like not a place you want to go visit. And certainly not a place that we want to continue to contaminate. They buried little weapons of mass destruction under the sand there. So that's what we're planning at Space Force. We had a software issue here that we're trying to deal with at the moment. And
okay. Well, while we do that, I'll tell you about our friends over at Bunker, if I am able. And maybe that will buy us some time for our system to come back up and running. So Bunker is a fantastic place to control your digital life, basically. It's a place where you can choose just one app for privacy, security, peace of mind. That's Bunker. It protects you against cyber criminals, scammers, surveillance, governments, AI. It's all up to you. But not only that, it's a place where your family can store your digital life together. So you think about, what happens if I die? Could my family get into my bank accounts? Could they get into my, you know, folders where our family documents are? Well, with Bunker, the answer would be yes, because it's a personal vault to securely store family photos, financial information, IDs, tax documents, insurance information, and more. It's a one app that delivers supercharged privacy and security, letting you store, share, and communicate freely with those you trust. So right now, you can go to bunker.life. Right now, use the code redacted and you'll get your first 3 months free. So give it a try. See what it's like to have everything, not just some stuff on a Dropbox, some stuff in a password manager, some stuff you have a spyware, all of that. No, it's all in one place. So go to the App Store and you can download Bunker or go to bunker.life, bunker.life. Use the code redacted and you'll get your first 3 months free. So once again, that's bunker.life. Use the code redacted.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle with ultra titanium alloy metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time for water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates, not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
All right, welcome back. Sorry, we had some technical issues and total crash of software and everything. So, but we are back. We've got a lot more news to get to. We've got three guests lined up for you, and we're going to get through all of them here. So let's dive into it.
Well, President Trump spoke with Russian President Putin for over 2 hours, and both reported the conversation was positive. They say a ceasefire is in the works, but they've been saying that for weeks. This weekend, Russian military reported that Ukraine is losing up to 1,300 servicemen per day. So what is the holdup? Well, we think that possibly it's a few things. One is NATO involvement. Obviously, Russia is still holding firm about no NATO membership for Ukraine, but both the U.S. and the UK have said that they will have troops stationed in Ukraine once the war ends. So isn't that kind of the same thing? Also, President Zelensky keeps talking nonsense about getting land back, particularly the land in eastern Ukraine and Crimea. Well, this means that everything that the war has been over in eastern Ukraine since early 2022 when Russia moved in and those people voted, plus Crimea, which is the peninsula that looks like an island. Do we have a map? I'd like to show you a part of that, or is that not possible?
I'm having trouble
if it's not possible.
The images up right now.
Okay. So anyhow, if you look at a map of where troops are currently stationed, Ukrainian troops, they are nowhere near the contested region. In fact, they are up on the border of Russia while the war takes place in what you see on your screen is red. Why are you, the blue dots are Ukrainian troops. What are they doing there? Why are we giving them all that money to not be on the front lines? I thought we wanted them on the front lines. I don't. I'd prefer they're there out of harm's way. But again, this is what we're calling a war. It's a simulation. So Rachel Blevins is an independent journalist. She's joining us to discuss. Her video analysis on X is a great place to start to figure out what is actually happening, not what's being said. So Rachel, thanks for sticking with us today. What is your analysis on what is the holdup for a ceasefire?
Yeah, well, thanks so much for having me. I know anyone who runs any kind of live stream online knows that you're going to go through some technical issues at some point, and they usually all come at once. And yeah, you know, it's been interesting to watch almost this kind of dance that Trump and Putin have been doing for a couple of months now. Trump obviously campaigned on this promise of ending the war in 24 hours. We all knew that that wasn't going to happen. But when it comes to what you're hearing from Russia's side, Putin has been very consistent in his demands. Yes, these regions are a major part of this. As you noted there, we have Crimea, which has been reincorporated into Russia since 2014. So more than a decade now, you have these four additional regions that voted to join Russia in 2022. And yet when we look at Zelensky's statements, he's off there in La La Land, right? He's still saying, oh no, we're still going to get this territory back. And he's saying that because he knows that Trump is hearing it. He also knows that Putin is hearing it. And I think another big factor here that Putin keeps bringing up is, okay, as soon as we agree to a full ceasefire, we have NATO ready to do everything that they can to rebuild Kiev's military. Russia doesn't want that to happen, but you still have Zelensky over here saying there will be no neutrality. So the major concerns that Russia has been bringing up, the U.S. and NATO, they have not acknowledged or properly addressed them. And so even though, yeah, we get 2 hours of talks on the phone, we get this promise that we're going to have more direct talks between Russia and Ukraine, it's kind of hard to see them coming to a deal anytime soon, just based on the fact that up until this point, you have them almost kind of in separate worlds when it comes to what everyone is asking for. It seems like Trump on his end is just kind of happy that he got Putin to agree to those direct talks until he goes to Zelensky. And then Zelensky says, wait a second, we just had direct talks last week. So again, they're all kind of in different spaces, and it's hard to see a deal coming together, at least in the immediate future.
One of the things you brought up, I think it's very important, is that Putin keeps saying over and over again, like Putin doesn't often just say things to just hear himself talk. Like he's repeating, like if we don't want like just a ceasefire, we want an end to the war, because as you point out, The ceasefire, to me, is really the canary in the coal mine here. It's the biggest problem. If there's a ceasefire, U.S. forces, British forces, French forces, NATO forces pouring into there to be like, hey, we got it.
Yeah.
And then we're now in a full-blown war with NATO. Is that the way I'm reading? Am I reading that correctly?
Yeah, that is the major concern, I think, for Russia right now, is that, you know, up until this point, when it comes to the concerns they've been talking about for over a decade, it has been NATO encroachment on their territory. And I think that's why you keep seeing Putin bring up the root causes of this conflict, because what he's saying is, look, these still have not been dealt with. And as we're watching the EU and the UK talking about wanting to send in thousands of troops, claiming that they're so-called peacekeepers, Putin is looking at that and going, hey, we could be facing a much more dangerous scenario than even what we're facing just right now with this ongoing war. And I think that Putin, too, is very wary of a Minsk III style deal. I mean, we saw this in 2014 and 2015. Russia wanted to go about this in not only a diplomatic way, but saying, hey, let's make a deal. Let's have what was at the time the breakaway republics, Donetsk and Lugansk, in the Donbass region. Let's have them work out an agreement with the new government, the new Western-backed government in Kiev, and Russia would kind of stay out of it. But that didn't work. And then on top of that, you had people like former German Chancellor Angela Merkel coming out after the fact and saying, yeah, we really just use those Minsk agreements in order to buy time to build up Kiev's military for a future war with Russia. And so when you look at everything that Russia has gone through over the last more than 3 years now, you know, becoming the most sanctioned nation in the world, being in a position where they have lost many lives, right? Not as many as Ukraine, but they still are in a position where they have paid a price. I think they want to make sure that whatever deal that there is at the end of this is something that is going to take into account what Russia has gained in this conflict. And you just have not seen the West even begin to acknowledge that, right? They still are in a position of insisting that Russia is asking for too much and really not acknowledging the reality of the situation on the battlefield.
I mean,
right. And so what do you make of the map? Were you able to see the map I pointed out that the Ukrainian troops are largely centered where the war is not and have been since the major counteroffensive we were told started? When did that counteroffensive in 2024, 2023? Now I'm losing track. And so they're not even fighting there. They don't know what they're doing. You feel so sorry for them because they're just forced conscriptions. And so I think most people who support the war in Ukraine don't realize we're sending all kinds of money into the garbage can and they're not even really trying to get territory back.
Yeah, and I think on top of that, you really see this emphasized when not just on the front lines, but with these additional attacks that Kiev is carrying out targeting Russian territory, right? None of these attacks are aimed at changing the situation along the front lines. They're all aimed at continuing to terrorize the Russian population, I guess trying to get them to turn against the Russian government, even though it has had the opposite effect. But beyond that, they are aimed at, you know, continuing on this war in a different way, continuing to keep Russia in a position where they are concerned about what attacks Kiev could carry out to target them. And yeah, I think you brought up a really important question that the American people should be asking themselves, which is, okay, why are we doing this, right? Why are we sending all of this money, all of these weapons over to Ukraine? Is this just about, you know, continuing to help out the military industrial complex? Is this just about hoping that one of these days Russia is going to be hurt by all of these sanctions and by this continued war in the way that the U.S. wants them to be hurt by it? If that's the goal, then we really should not continue on in this way with this ongoing support for the war in Ukraine. And I think that, you know, it was very telling when you saw Vice President J.D. Vance this week say, oh, well, Putin just doesn't know how to get out of this war, because it almost seemed like he was talking about the U.S., right? The U.S. is in a position where they bit off more than they could chew. They thought that the war that the proxy war that they did launch against Russia was going to have much more serious consequences on Russia than it did. And now they're in a position of going, okay, how do we quote unquote get out of this without having another Afghanistan where it is just a complete disaster that now is on our U.S. foreign policy record?
Yeah. Excellent point.
Great points. Rachel, thank you for sticking with us here while we had all these tech issues today. I know we got pushed you way back in time, and we appreciate it. Thanks for sticking with us. Rachel Blevins, everyone. Great to see you as always. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks, Rachel. All right. Coming up on the show, we got more news. We're going to talk about
Clayton. Are you noticing a pattern with these, though? We don't want the war to keep going, but we will keep sending weapons. Same with Gaza.
Yeah, we want it to end, but we're going to continue to send you weapons and Patriot
and
systems
money.
And HIMARS and money because, you know, it's like why right before Biden was leaving office, of course, they were funneling as much money as they could. They were pushing as much money as they could out the door. And it was, I mean, it was criminal to me. It's treasonous. And now we have a new administration that's still allowing this to happen. Still allowing these monies to flow, still allowing these weapons to flow.
Right. To my mind, that should have happened on day one of the Trump administration is all of that dries up. Full stop.
Yeah.
Right. That's showing that you really want things to stop. So we really want to see some bold moves like this. We're happy for the friendly conversations. Absolutely. Because it's at least friendlier than what we got from Joe Biden or whoever that was during the Biden administration. But it's incredibly frustrated. So give a thumbs up if you feel the same way. All right, we got more news to get to. We're going to talk about how Poland is done being run rampant by Ukrainian refugees and being told to be basically the dumping ground for the garbage dump of the war in Ukraine. It's not fair to them. Mike Krupa will join us. We're also going to talk about Alberta and how they are serious. They really might want to leave. I mean, they really do want to leave Canada. Will it happen? We're going to talk about that. But first,
I don't know if you saw this new JP Morgan report that just came out. $4,000 for gold, for the price of gold. That's their prediction. That's on top of the Goldman Sachs predictions, which is $4,500 or more for gold in the next year. And then, of course, you had yesterday the breaking news that we broke right here on the show. Yes, the European Central Bank warning that gold is a threat to Europe. It's a big, really big threat to Europe right now. Why? They literally made that announcement the moment that Putin and Trump got off the phone and talked about immediate ceasefire negotiations and putting an end to this war. So the ECB is like, oh, we can't have gold because that's going to create a massive instability inside of Europe. We have this printing press, this fake printing press where we continue to print all of this fake money. And you're not going to have access to that anymore. We're not going to have access to that anymore. And we're worried about gold. So they issued that alert. And that's why, you know, so many banks right now are buying up as much gold as they can get their hands on, because it's so important to have gold as part of your portfolio. So let's talk about our friends over at Lear Capital, because if you want to start investing in gold, you can. And you can call them. Just get on the phone and ask them, hey, how can I transfer some of these sort of fake U.S. dollars into actual precious minerals? And they'll get on the phone with you, have a great conversation with you. All you need to do is call their 800 number, 1-800-613-3557, or just go to the website, learredacted.com. Uncertainty is everywhere right now, but gold is shining. Gold is, to me, the most important asset that you can have in your family to protect your family. Uncertainty is everywhere. In fact, it's already hit a 10-year new record high this year alone, gold did, outperforming the stock market by a wide margin. Gold is up 16%, while the Dow has dropped 4%. So give them a call right now. Just talk to them about investing. 1-800-613-3557 for your free guide, or go to learredacted.com. And just get on the phone with these guys. They're amazing. They're an American company, and they will walk you through the entire process. And no obligation, too. Just have a conversation with them. They're an education company first, before anything else.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle. With ultra titanium alloy metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time. For water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates, not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, Spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Well, Poland is collapsing in real time as their wide open border policies have changed that country forever, unless they can reverse it. Can they reverse it? I don't know. Now social tensions are skyrocketing thanks to millions of Ukrainians who've moved into Poland, completely altered that country. Even the BBC, look at this, acknowledging social tensions are out of control in Poland. Go back to Ukraine, reads the headline. War refugees complain of abuse in Poland. And I want to quote a few things from this BBC article here, which you can see. She is one of dozens of Ukrainians living in Poland who've told the BBC that anti-Ukrainian sentiment has risen considerably in recent months. Many described experiencing abuse on public transport, bullying in schools, xenophobic material online. At work, many people have been saying Ukrainians come here and have behaved badly. And my Ukrainian friends say they want to go home because Polish people don't accept us. It's frightening to live here now. According to government stats, at least 2.5 million Ukrainians live in Poland, comprising almost 7% of the total population of Poland. And here's my favorite. Research suggests that Poland's public opinion of Ukrainians is indeed worsening. According to a March 2025 poll by the respected CBOS Center, just 50% of Poles are in favor of accepting Ukrainian refugees, a fall of 7 percentage points in 4 months. And 2 years ago, that figure was 81%. And I love that they bury this next sentence kind of here in the middle of the article or towards the end. Around 1 million Ukrainians are officially registered as having arrived after the start of the full-scale invasion. Poland spends 4.2% of its GDP on Ukrainian refugees. There it is. That's the point, right? How much money they're spending. Dr. Mike Krupa, academic researcher, political commentator in Warsaw, Poland, posted this on X. Gee, who could have seen this coming? Social tensions due to basically open border immigration policy. How shocking. How shocking indeed. That was the tweet. And Dr. Michael Krupa joins us now. Who could have seen this coming, doctor?
Well, I can tell you, by the way, great to be back on your show, Clayton, Natalie.
Great to have you.
A lot of people saw this coming. I remember I was tweeting hashtags immigration moratorium now back in, 2018, 2019. You could have noticed that things were changing in the social sphere in Poland where, you're taking a tram ride in the middle of a large Polish city and you're hearing more and more Ukrainian and you're hearing more and more Russian. That was understandable to some extent because after the Maidan revolt and the beginning of the war in Ukraine in 2014, you had a large influx of Ukrainians to Poland. But the understanding was that, even though they were in the several hundred thousands, they were here for temporary work and that one day they would go back. Well, it turns out that just the opposite happened, that more and more Ukrainians came to Poland as part of this influx of legal migration, i.e. cheap labor. Then when the war itself was initiated to a new kinetic level in February 2022, you obviously had that influx of millions of Ukrainian refugees coming into Poland. Refugees, you take that into quotation marks in many respects, because a lot of these people were not refugees. In fact, they paid their way to get into Poland. A lot of them weren't even Ukrainian. Basically, there was no verification method for who was coming into Poland after February 2022. So we could have been essentially letting in, Al-Qaeda terrorists, ISIS, anybody who wanted to get into Poland in February 2022, could basically get in. And now we're seeing the results of this imposed from the top, in line with globalist tendencies and expectations from our Brussels masters, obviously, the politics of multiculturalism being enforced onto Poland and the reaction of Polish society, sometimes nasty, but sometimes understandable to this phenomenon.
Xavier in our chat says, it's hilarious when the Eurozone and the Euro media calls it net migration. Net migration, right? I mean, so you've got, and it's all just all part of the process. It's just a natural flow. It's a natural flow, nothing to see here, nothing to worry about. And the Eurozone, of course, they don't care about borders at all. They don't care about Polish sovereignty. They don't care about your national interests at all. Just open your doors, flood the system. And I put up that statistic about the GDP and how much now of Poland's resources are going to support this. Is that number accurate or way too low, do you think? I think it said 4.2%.
I've seen numbers that differ slightly. They go a little bit up to around 5, just under 6%. So they're generally in that same area. We should also consider is that, for example, it was recorded that in 2023 alone, about 17 billion Polish zlotys were transferred from Poland to Ukraine as part of Ukrainian remittance that were going to Ukrainians living in Ukraine from Ukrainians working in Poland, or not working, but somehow getting money. One of the ideas that I've come up with, and I'm trying to pitch to a lot of our politicians here, is that we should tax at least at a 1% level of those remittances, and not only to Ukrainians, because I'm talking about citizens from non-EU countries that are in Poland, but most of them, everybody knows, are Ukrainians, because, you know, that money is flowing out and we're literally getting nothing for it. At least the budget could be supplanted with a couple of $100 million for that, and that could be invested into a Polish workforce instead of, basically inviting the entire world to Poland, making us an even less, basically a wage depression paradise, so to say. So the discussion right now about the Ukrainian phenomenon in Poland, or was what some people call, like our common friend Grzegorz Brown, the Ukrainization of Poland, which is a fact, unfortunately, has gained traction. People are taking notice, and it's hard not to take notice when everything around you begins to change, when you're hearing foreign language. And the funny thing is that most of the foreign language that you're hearing is actually not Ukrainian, it's actually Russian. But we're supposed to believe that Russia is the bad guy, and yet we allow ourselves to be flooded with Russian speakers. That's another paradox for another conversation.
So these are Ukrainians. These are Ukrainians that speak Russian.
Yeah. I mean, it's the same kind of paradox as we learned today, that the negotiations that were taking place in Istanbul between the Ukrainians and the Russians were conducted in what? In Russian. So right. There you go. As I said, you have Russophobes in Poland that are running around. We hate Russia. We hate everything Russian. There is no Russian culture. But at the same time, hey, what the hell? Let's bring in a couple of million Russian speakers to Poland, because that makes perfect sense. So
you talked about Brown, Grzegorz Brown, who's, of course, running for your leadership in Poland. You're in the middle of election season right now. How much traction do you think that message is getting, like the Ukrainianization of Poland? I mean, is it fringe? Is it 60%, 70%? Is the country just fed up with all of this sort of NATO intervention, EU intervention? We had Mr. Braun on the show a few weeks ago, and right after he had torn down the EU flag and taken it outside and lit it on fire. And I mean, I saw so many comments from Polish people that say, yes, finally, 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 the Polish people are sick of it. It seems like, I mean, if you're able to gauge, you know, an interview with him and the response from that, is it taking hold?
Yes, it's definitely taking hold. The official opinion polls from the last 3 years are showing a tendency towards two things. So first, less and less people are accepting of the idea that we should be accepting more and more Ukrainian refugees. That's one. And the second trend is that less and less Poles are open to the idea that we should be accepting more and more migrants as such. So not only from Ukraine, but from other countries outside of the EU. So the trend is going in a positive direction. People are seeing what's happening, you know, in the labor market. People are seeing that the prices of real estate is going up due to the influx. People are seeing wage depression in some sectors of the labor market, which is a natural effect of mass legal immigration, unfortunately. I mean, you in the States are perfect witnesses to that. We're seeing it in Poland right now. So the trends are going in the right direction. What we need right now is a spark that will light up this social anger into a potent political movement. Now, Grzegorz Brown has, in a way, done that. He was a candidate in the first round of presidential elections, which took place on Sunday. He came in fourth, which surprised the hell out of a lot of people in Poland, garnering just over 6% of the vote. So that's about 1,200,000 voters that voted for Xegos Brown. But the guy who came in third place, Slavomir Mensen, he would be sort of a conservative libertarian. He garnered 15% of the vote, just under 15% of the vote. And he too is generally skeptical of the entire Ukrainian phenomenon. So if you combine the two, you have about 21% of the Polish electorate that voted in the presidential election that doesn't want more immigration and doesn't want more Ukrainians in Poland and wants to stop this process of turning our society into, if not a multicultural entity, then a sort of bicultural entity where you have two nations living in the same country. So the trends are going in that direction. Now we have a runoff election. The second round is going to take place in 2 weeks between Karol Nawrocki and Rafał Trzaskowski, the current mayor of Warsaw. We can't expect any positive moves on the immigration front from Trzaskowski. He's a total Soros apostle. But Nawrocki, on the other hand, he has signaled during the campaign that he is open to some of the arguments of the immigration restrictionists, such as myself, or the immigration hawks, as we're called. We'll see where that goes. Nawrocki, if he wants to win, he's representing the official right. If he wants to win, he's going to have to make concessions to the voters of Brown and Mensen. So what those concessions will be, my main concession would be this. Karol Nawrocki, if you want to become president of Poland, on the first day of your administration, you send to the parliament the bill on a 5-year immigration moratorium, straight up. And that would be my condition. We'll see where the candidates line up on that.
Yeah, I think they're going to have to if they want to try to win over some of the support from Braun supporters and otherwise. Do you think they might end up doing sort of an about face like we've seen from Keir Starmer in the UK? You know, telling us that open borders are fine, immigration is fine, embrace your neighbors, all of these things. And then suddenly, I don't know, he's had like a complete about face over the past few weeks, telling us how, you know, we want English to be the spoken language of the UK. We want borders closed. We want to shut down. So sort of placating their base, but secretly wanting to actually close down the borders in Poland. Do you think that that's the case?
I don't think the liberal side, Trzaskowski, in this case, so the guy who won the first round of the election, the current mayor of Warsaw, thinks in those terms. If he were to sound, you know, like even a slight immigration restrictionist, just to bring some people over to his side before the second round, I would say that's totally insincere on his part, because he has done nothing in his political career that would suggest that he gives a hoot about Poland retaining its Polishness, basically, right? Its cultural identity and social cohesion. Nawrocki, on the other hand, is a slightly different story. He probably will be open to some sort of immigration restrictionist moves on the part of Poland. And he might be able to generate some momentum behind a bill, because a president can also present a bill in the Polish parliament in our constitutional system. But my personal opinion is that it does not go far enough. Unless we take radical measures right now, we're going to be living in a completely different country, and not even in 10 years, in 2-3 years. There are already rumblings in the Polish media coming, obviously, from such organizations as basically organizations that are mediators for bringing cheap labor into Poland and workers, that are already saying that we are ready to import another 1 million Ukrainians into Poland in the next 2 years. So if we don't cut this Gordian knot right now, we're going to have way more problems in the future. So I'm hoping Nawrocki will radicalize, so to say, in the next couple of weeks, see the problems. Maybe his meetings with Brown, his interactions with Mensen will show him the scale of the problem. Although, as I said, if you're living in a large city in Poland, or even a middle city in Poland, you know, with a population of, let's say, 200,000 or 150,000, you do see the problem. So it's not rocket science to see where this phenomenon is heading towards. And I'm hoping that Nawrocki will internalize some of the arguments I'm making here.
Another 1 million Ukrainians pouring into Poland. Holy smokes. People better wake up. People better wake up. Unbelievable. Dr. Mike Krupa is awake. Thank you for staying up late with us there in Warsaw. We appreciate it. We had a bunch of technical issues today, so thanks for sticking with us today, Doc. It's always great to see you. Thanks for your analysis, and we'll be watching what happens with this election very closely. Thanks again.
Always a pleasure. Have a good one, guys. Take care.
Thanks, Mike. Appreciate it. All right, coming up here on the show, we are going to talk about another country that's in the middle of a calamity right now, chaos, if you will, and that is the country of Canada. And Alberta is ready to leave. ready to leave and go out on its own, tired of being pushed around on climate policies and ridiculous news for that province. We're going to talk with David Creighton about that. He's also got some big breaking news that we're going to share here on the show in just a moment. But first, the revolution of cryptocurrency. You know, stop investing in meme coins that are scamming you out of your savings. Invest in real Bitcoin and grow your wealth using BlockTrust IRA and Animus AI. Are you ready to break free from the outdated buy and hold crypto strategies and unlock the true potential of cryptocurrency? Well, if you welcome yourself now to the cryptocurrency revolution, BlockTrust IRA, their AI-driven technology predicts the market with computer-driven accuracy. Whether you have a retirement account like a 401k or IRA or just cash savings sitting in a bank account somewhere, making you little to no interest, BlockTrust's IRA clients are able to maximize their earnings potential and outperform the market. They're the only crypto management firm in the market right now using cutting-edge technology to improve returns and significantly reduce risk. Crypto has created more than 80,000 new millionaires in just the last year, and you could be next. BlockTrust IRA makes financial freedom available to everyone by accepting both IRAs and cash investments from around the world. So if you've got an old IRA just sitting around, you can move it over and actually start investing in crypto. Unlike meme coins or scams that prey on hardworking Americans, BlockTrust IRA has the best-in-class military-grade technology, and their clients are 100% insured for up to $200 million of insurance. And they're named Bitcoin Magazine's number one crypto trading fund. It's BlockTrust IRA. So go right now to redactednewscrypto.com, right there on your screen, redactednewscrypto.com, or call their 800 number and talk to the team over there, 1-800-649-6732. Again, it's 1-877-649-6732 to get started today. And I actually have an old IRA from one of my old companies that I left. I used that IRA and rolled that into crypto investing, and to be able to invest inside of my IRA self-directed, it's really, really powerful. And it depends on what IRA you have, but then that grows tax-free. So upon retirement, that money is tax-free. And you can use that IRA, you know, you can invest in real estate, you can do other things inside of it as well. Well, let's talk about Canada now. Alberta's separatist movement is gaining momentum following Prime Minister Mark Carney's recent election victory there. The idea is surging in popularity. Break free of the corrupt Canada government. Many Albertans have already expressed growing frustration over their federal climate policies, which are, I mean, widely perceived as detrimental to the province's oil and gas industry. Alberta, in many ways, provides the oil and gas that runs Canada, that fuels Canada. So why should they be bullied and pushed around? So this hits them hard. And now there's momentum for independence from Canada. Premier Danielle Smith has announced that a referendum on Alberta's separation from Canada will be held next year if a citizen-led petition garners sufficient support there. David Creighton, independent journalist in Ottawa, Canada, joins us now. He's been covering this in extensively. He's got the great show Creighton's Right as well, which you can watch and streaming on X. And David, you did a show today saying that Canada is nearing a calamity. So maybe you can break down all of these pieces for us. I want to get to Alberta in a second, but what disaster is really Canada facing right now?
Canada is facing the breakup of the country. And there's no question in my mind that's imminent. Because we're not having a referendum in 2026. We're having a referendum in the fall of 2025. The Alberta Prosperity Project is leading this independence movement. And we had people at the move at the movement in Calgary a week ago in on Monday. 1,200 people, and people crashing in the doors in Calgary because they wanted to vote for Alberta independence. And let me tell you, it's never been higher. And I've watched this for years because as a Western Canadian, I was born and bred in British Columbia. I know Western Canada very well. It's never been higher. Western Canada poll came out last week, 3 days ago. 52% of Albertans would vote in favor of staying in Canada, 48% leaving. Now, this is only after a few weeks of Mark Carney. I predict it's going to go much higher. And if Mark Carney and the liberals ignore this, they think it's just fringe elements, they're crazy. This is the most absolute direct hit against federalism that's ever happened in this country. It's even broader than what's happened in Quebec in the past. So I would say this is historic, what's going on right now.
Is there anything that Mark Carney could do to kind of walk this back? Or is this, is he doubling down right now and forcing? I see a bunch of people in the chat room saying, man, time to buy some land in Calgary right now. And Cole's Towing in our chat room on Rumble says, Alberta is supporting the entire country. They have a right to be pissed.
Alberta provides $13.2 billion in revenue to the rest of the country in what's called equalization payments, meaning they have to give away their resources to the rest of the country. Every Albertan gives away $30,000 minimum on average to the federal government. So what is the Alberta independence movement selling? Well, Alberta as an independent province would no longer have to give away $13 billion of its resources to the federal government so it can dispense them to other provinces. And every individual Albertan would be $30,000 richer. This is a powerful argument, powerful argument. And if I can just break in with this breaking news today, this is going to make it even more powerful because I reported on this on this station. Chris Carbert, he was one of the so-called notorious members of this group that blockaded the Coots Four, that blockaded the border between Alberta and Manitoba.
Right.
In September, he was handed a 6.5-year sentence, basically for mischief and possession of a dangerous weapon. So he was up for parole this week. Parole, just parole. And despite the prison saying he was doing everything possible to make things better for himself, he even recanted being part of the horrible Coots Four. It wasn't good enough. The parole board said, no, he stays in prison for the full term. And the state broadcaster, I like to call them a Soviet broadcaster, CBC, they reported this in the same way as the Stalinist press would have in 1935 when the show trials were going on. And they said, yes, he tried to recant. He tried to pretend he wasn't part of those horrible anti-mandate truckers, but it wasn't good enough. Because they said he wasn't really telling the truth. And that is going to strike a heart with Albertans who say, I've had enough of this federal government. Even though this charge and even though this conviction came from a provincial court, it's a result of the Federal Emergencies Act under Justin Trudeau. And this is going to invigorate and galvanize supporters of the independence like nothing else has before.
So you really think, I look at the other day we were doing our live stream. I was just kind of hanging out with a bunch of Canadians here and talking about this, and they were educating me about it. You know, I'm pretty ignorant when it comes to how this would operate here, but you've got Alberta, which is in many ways landlocked. Right. I mean, you're stuck between Saskatchewan and British Columbia. Right. So you have no really, I think, unless I'm wrong, like navigable waterways. And we know how countries operate when they don't really have, or cities and countries and throughout Africa where the British and the French have just stamped a country in the middle of Africa. And they have no navigable waterway. So they're sort of like a landlocked country. They're like, we wouldn't have chosen to put ourselves here. Britain did it. This is, we're a country now. We have no way of getting water. We have no ports. We have no. So Educate me on that. I mean, how would Alberta sustain itself being sort of sandwiched between all of this?
The trade in Canada has always been north-south, not east-west. And it's rational because Albertans have more in common with people from Manitoba and other states that are Midwest than they do with Ontario or in Quebec. And it's almost like, you know, I hate to say it, but Donald Trump said there was this line drawn between these two countries that didn't make much sense. And in many ways, it doesn't. And a lot of Albertans are also seeking to be the 51st state in this. And there was a delegation, I've reported on this previously on this show, of people going to Washington. And these aren't just a bunch of idiots. These are high-level people in Alberta, seeing if the government would actually entertain the idea of Alberta being the 51st state, not Canada, but Alberta. And of course they would. How would you possibly say no? This is a province with untold resources, a limited population, and it would be a wonderful relationship. So this is what's happening right now. People are getting very excited in Alberta, but the possibility of losing that $30,000 that they pay to the federal government every year, or becoming part of what Donald Trump is doing in the United States. So and Mark Carney, of course, Prime Minister Mark Carney, our current prime minister, is not taking this very seriously. He thinks he can buy off Alberta with what? Maybe a pipeline? But no, this is Mark Carney is the globalist leader who has been all about net zero and stopping provinces like Alberta from producing natural resources, from selling their natural resources to other countries or anywhere else. So I see nothing but disaster for this for Canada. However, I don't necessarily, at this point in my life, I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. Because Mark Carney is taking us down such a horrible globalist road that I don't know if there's anything left in this country. Because if enough people in Canada were stupid enough to vote for this man who you're showing on screen, for Mark Carney, I don't know if this country deserves to exist as it always has, because it's no longer the Canada I grew up with. It's no longer the Canada I fought for as a member of the Canadian Armed Forces. It is pretty well gone. And we've got a prime minister who probably initiated the most incompetent, inept cabinet in the history of Canada.
Maureen in our chat room on Rumble, she says, I'm a proud separatist Albertan. My father served in the Canadian military for almost 3 decades and thankfully isn't here to see the destruction of our beloved Canada. Please help us. PDJT, please help us. So I'll get you out of here on this, David, which is, where do things stand now with this separatist movement? What are the mile markers or kilometer markers, I guess I should say, for you up there in Canada this road?
There's going to be a referendum on this, not in 2026, as promised by Premier Danielle Smith, but there's going to be an earlier one with the fall provincial elections. And I can tell you this, though, what has really gotten people mad is the absolute incompetence of this Mark Carney cabinet. And I just have to mention a few of these if we have time to do that.
Sure.
Stephen Guilbeault, you remember him? The environment and climate change minister? He's back. Yeah. He's back.
Good.
As the so-called Canadian identity and culture minister, whatever the heck that means. But that does mean he can start to implement Trudeau's censorship bills. Who else? Sean Fraser. This is the man who failed miserably, miserably as housing minister. He's back as attorney general. They've made him attorney general, the justice minister. But the real, this is what really kills me. The former mayor of Vancouver, Gregor Robertson, 10 years as the mayor of Vancouver. And during those 10 years, he drove up the price of homes in Vancouver to the highest, not in Canada. No, no, wait for this. The highest in North America. You can't afford a home in Vancouver any more than you can in San Francisco, in New York. It's that expensive. So what did Mark Carney do with Gregor Robertson? First time he ever ran federally as a member of parliament. Mark Carney made him the housing minister. So people are saying, what is going on with this man's mind? He doubled the prices of homes in Vancouver, and I have to add this. He destroyed one of the most beautiful cities in North America with free access to toxic drugs. Everything was available during his 10 years as premier. He made it possible to do your drugs anywhere you want, and the government will provide them. And that's his legacy. And that's who Mark Carney appointed as his housing minister. And this is an absolute outrage. And if you don't think Alberta is watching this right now and saying, I've had enough, we're leaving. And I tell you this, as somebody who grew up in Western Canada but lives in Ontario right now, I don't blame them at all.
I would love it. I would love to see this happen. This would be amazing. It would be an amazing stick in the eye to these globalists. All of the resources, all of the fuel, all of the natural gas, oil, everything else that Albertans provide to Canada and North America. It'd just give a big middle finger to Mark Carney and the federal government. It would be amazing to watch. David Creighton, great to talk with you. Great to see you again. And thanks for sticking with us. We had all these technical issues today, and thanks for going late with us today. I really appreciate it.
Well, redacted is always worth it. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks, David. Appreciate it. And thanks to all of you for subscribing and being a part of our show. Now, so I've received a couple of messages from people recently who said that it appears that on YouTube that Redacted is shadow banned. I don't know if that's the truth or not. People have to dig to try to find our show. I know that I know that YouTube unsubscribes people on a regular basis from our show. This happens all the time. So if we have like 30,000 new subscribers in a particular month, it's because, well, we got 30,000 new subscribers, but then they for some reason think that you shouldn't be following our show, and then they unsubscribe you. It's like, this is what we're dealing with right now. It's unbelievable. So anyway, if you're not already subscribed, please subscribe. And if you're watching us on Rumble, please click the subscribe button there as well and join us. And if you're watching us on X, I know we've got many thousands of you watching us over on X as well. Please subscribe there, and Twitch too. So thank you guys for being a part of our community here. We really appreciate it. And thank you so much for dealing with all of our technical issues today. We apologize for that. We apologize. Well, thank you guys. We're going to be back tomorrow at 4 p.m. Eastern time, as we always are. Barring some unforeseen occurrence, we will be here. And thank you guys for being a part of our community. Thanks for the feedback, as always. And we'll see you tomorrow. Have a great night, everyone.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week.
Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.